Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. We welcome back friend of the podcast, PhD Strategy Director Chris Stevenson.
Happy to be friendly. Hello, Tim.
And my co-host, Mumbrella Deputy Editor Robin Hicks.
Hi, Tim.
This week,
we're going to call the whole thing Danthan Industries because it's Daniel and Nathan combined, because it's the Dan from Daniel. It's the Than from Nathan. So you put it together, Danthan. Well, it's Danthan because Nathan.
James Warburton gets his start date at 10.
Chris updates us on his media manifesto.
Celebrity chef Matt Moran and his, dummy spit.
Tobacco branding up in smoke.
Rocking out with the latest radio rankings.
Talent contests, budding chefs and a sack of potatoes in this week's TV ratings.
The Bolt Report doesn't make many friends. So before we get into this properly, just as we were starting to record the podcast, news came through that there was a verdict on the long-running James Warburton battle for when he can be released from his obligations to 7 and move over to 10. Start date is January the 1st. He'd actually been reckoning he'd start in July, and 7 had been attempting to make him stay until the following October. So I'm not sure who's the winner and who's the loser there. What on the surface of it, what do you reckon, Robin?
Well, yeah. I mean, he was originally, the threat was to start until October. I think it's possibly a win for 10, do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I think that it falls in the middle, doesn't it? I think that one party wanted to get going early, another wanted to go a lot later, and we found ourselves somewhere in the middle.
Lachlan Murdoch has now, I guess, got to babysit the network for several more months, which I guess probably wasn't what he had in mind.
It probably wasn't, and there'll no doubt a while ago have been plans and procedures put in place for this kind of eventuality. So I'm sure they know what they're going to do for the next half year or so till we get to Jan 1.
Well, more on all of the legal shenanigans involving 7 and 10 at mumbrella.com.au. Next, we talk Media Manifesto. So, Chris, welcome back to the podcast. Before we get into the manifesto, what's been going on at PhD since we last spoke?
PhD has had a very interesting couple of months. We've been enjoying a lot of the growth we saw last year and consolidating that, and a little bit of inward looking, a little internal facing, and making sure that our product and what we're doing and what's going out the door is as good and as market leading as it can be. So some changes, some developments, some very specific work streams have been developed internally just to really evolve the agency, move the agency on, and we're all quite excited about that.
I bumped into you at a Strataday a few Saturdays ago where I think you had some of your young charges with you. I guess that's something you do. You just try to sort of expose your staff to interesting things that get them thinking strategically.
Absolutely. No, yeah, so
maybe explain what Strataday was.
Strataday was Mark Pollard's a rainy Saturday morning where some strategic folk, if you can imagine that, gathered to really just talk strategy. And I describe the day as brilliant basics, and credit to Mark actually for putting it together and for getting people there on what was a fairly miserable Saturday morning to have a great conversation, debate and discussion about strategy. And I think that for me, that's essentially what I try to do with PhD. It's how do we stimulate that debate, that conversation about good thinking and impart knowledge about brands, how they grow, how they work, and how media and media investment can help do that.
Now, so, I do remember seeing on your blog that you said a little bit more about Strataday, so it's worth having a little look there. Remind us of the name of the blog.
You can find it's Mediation, and you can find Mediation at chrisstevenson.typepad.com.
And Mark Pollard, we've carried the news this week that he's off to New York, which we knew already, but he's revealed the job, which is one of the global planning directors the global planning director on Lenovo for Saatchi & Saatchi. So a big job and good luck to him.
Big job and very best of luck. Great guy.
But last time we were here, we were just beginning to get underway for the Media Manifesto, which is one of the kind of interesting and new parts, I guess, that hopefully helps set Mumbrella 360 up as just not your typical conference. Let's talk about progress. How's it going?
It's going really well. So just to reiterate what the session is about, the idea is that for that session at Umbrella 360, for the manifesto session, which is on day one, the audience will not be passive observers. It won't be that the extent of interaction will be a question at the end of the session. It's very much turning the tables and making everyone who's in that session active participants in discussing and debating different areas and topics of media and generating very specific articles of belief, generating some very specific things that we believe need to change or adapt or positioning statements that will evolve us and move us on as an industry. We are in challenging times. We are in very interesting times. And the ambition of the session is that we get some consensus and some collective belief in how we as an industry should be tackling those changes and challenges.
What do you expect the key bone of contention to be? What do you think the industry's biggest beef is with media?
I think that one of the very interesting areas that's emerging in the pre-discussion, there's a team of people who from a whole lot of different agencies, some independents and some publishers, are working over the course of, have been and will work for the next few weeks over the areas of interest. And so there are some very interesting ones emerging. Remuneration. Right. Is a really interesting one, and how do we come to a collective point of view on remuneration and how remuneration is fair and how everyone's voice gets heard in that debate. So that's going to be a very interesting area. I think relationships and this parish raised the issue of publisher and agency relationships. I think that's going to be an interesting area where we get some quite specific points of view and where consensus is really needed to be reached on that. I think it's a conversation that started a few months ago but never really finished. And so I think that we'd love to get some consensus on that. And then I think some of the more intangible conversations, but interesting ones, will be on things like the changing broadcast model and how we adapt and evolve to a very changing media landscape, and how we need automation. And one of the things that I hope will come out is a collective sense and a collective belief that if it can be automated, it should, because we've got too many people in too many places doing tasks that should be automatic.
And of course, the automated trading is the subject of a separate session all on its very own as well.
Absolutely. So. And the ambition as well is that Manifesto could and should tie into other sessions over the course of the conference. So it's more of an integrated session from that point of view, yeah, as well.
Can I just ask, is the whole idea, was it born out of sort of soul searching at PhD? And do you expect that the conference to change how you guys work as an agency, or is it more about, you know, challenging the industry?
I think it's in PhD's DNA to be challenging and to be thoughtful about how we do what we do. I think that the nature of the session is born out of our philosophy and our approach, which is about integration. It is about involving all the parties that need to be involved in the solution. We believe that all of us are better than any of us, and it's also born out of an ambition to really differentiate and create a session that might not be something that people are used to or have been exposed to before.
Well, for more information on all the goings-on at the conference, visit mumbrella360.com.au. Next, celebrity chef Matt Moran and his apparent dummy spit.
With more than 94.5 million active users globally, eBay is the world's largest online marketplace. Visit advertise.ebay.com.au.
We were presented with the latest marketing stunt video this week, and this one conveniently featured new MasterChef judge Matt Moran. Let's take a listen.
I've just been half an hour putting that perfectly on a plate. You come along and you throw in the fucking bin. Yeah, but I don't care what you're fucking resetting. There's nothing wrong with that food. That's been wasteful. It could have fed one of these guys. Could have fed me. Get it out of the bin and put it back on the fucking plate.
No way,
you guys do it? No fucking way. There's nothing wrong with that food. How wasteful is that? You know, it's just,
we just asked him to.
Well, mate, if this is your job, you do fucking shoots like this all the time, you waste food like that, I don't want fucking anything to do with it. Get yourselves another chef. Now, piss off.
So that was the gem, which was supposedly leaked by a crew member on set of a TV commercial Matt Moran was filming. Shock horror. It turns out that the video was a stunt for Oz Harvest, a charity Moran is backing, where restaurants give leftover food to homeless shelters. the Sydney Morning Herald, Felfrit, Hook, Line and Sinker. So, Chris, what do you think? A good way to draw attention to the initiative or just another lame stunt?
I think there's two stories here. And the first one is definitely that of what I think is a very good, solid, credible stunt. I think it's a great issue to be raised. I think that strategically they went about that in a great way. They found someone who was relevant in the area, who had a credible point of view, and then gave quite an entertaining and thought-provoking angle on it. So I think that as a stunt, it was well done.
Mm. What about the delivery? Sort of an effing blinding chef representing a charity. That's slightly greater with me. I just wonder whether you found it crass at all.
I didn't find it crass. I think that in this day and age, if a charity needs to get attention, if that's how they get it, then they should be getting it. I think that I don't think charities have the luxury of saying, is this too crass? I think that if they can get attention, they'll get it. And I sympathise with that position.
So, Tim, you exposed SMH for trying to cover their tracks in an opinion piece that you wrote. So what do you think? Do you think SMH will be embarrassed by this? What do you think their response would be?
Well, firstly, it was interesting, actually, because after we made the point that they, you know, the original story, which said, hey, look, here's some video of Matt Moran losing his temper, bloody, bloody, blah, that was then replaced with a story where the SMH was in on the joke, and it was, hey, look, here's the latest viral stunt with all trace vanishing of the previous one. Now, the SMH got very cross after I pointed this out, saying that this was in no way an attempt to deceive their readers, and it's just standard practice that when news breaks, you update the story.
But there's updating and there's sort of rewriting history, isn't there, to avoid embarrassment?
That's the issue. And I think the thing is, it's almost, okay, well, like, I'm not sure the defence, well, we always do it, so it's okay, necessarily, you know, works. Whether there was an unethical decision, you know, I'm sure there wasn't. You know, I'm sure it's just like, that's what they always do. They just update the latest thing, you know, never wrong for long, as, you know, some people are kind of known to say. I know that our policy tends to be, if we get something significant wrong and people are talking about it in the comments thread, for instance, if we change it, we'll acknowledge it in the comments thread that we have, or put a strike through as something we've done in the past. In other words, we won't just try and pretend it didn't happen. We'll sort of, you know, we'll move on. Now, whether the decision of the individual journalists was to try and pretend it, that they weren't hoaxed, or whether that was just the outcome by the fact that they were rewriting it, you know, we can never know for sure. But regardless, the output is the same.
Mm. There's on the effectiveness of the stunt itself. It seems to me that the kerfuffle that followed the stunt has sort of buried the actual message of the stunt itself. The fact that this is for a charity, don't waste food. Do you think there's a sense in that SMH's embarrassment and the follow up for the stunt is overcrowded the stunt itself?
I think that's probably true to say for certain media circles. And I think that in the kind of conversations that will go on with media people and listeners of this podcast, I think that there arguably is a valid and very relevant media story to be had. For most people who are exposed to that stunt, for most people who the charity will be seeking to engage with and influence, I wouldn't have thought that was the case.
Yeah, I'd agree. I found myself on 2UE, an hour or two after we'd written the story. They just wanted me to sort of come on quickly and talk about it. Paul Murray, who's been on this podcast before, made a real point of talking about OzHarvest and the work they do in that conversation, so it wasn't missed out of the conversation. So, yeah, you know, I'd argue that probably it was an effective piece of communication.
I do think this raises very, very interesting and valid issues about the nature of journalism and how journalism is changing. I think that what we saw here was effectively print journalism practices being adapted to the online space, and they simply cannot. Journalism is changing. When you do journalism online and when you look at stories online, you are living in a world where you are transparent. You are living in a world where information is freely available and where we have access to, in all intents and purposes, infinite amounts of information. And I think that the story will change, and I think you've got to be transparent in how your reporting of that story is changing.
So next, tobacco branding up in smoke.
Now, we had a guest posting, and I'm really sorry because I don't know how to pronounce his name, but I'm going to have a bash. Leo Bajzert, B-A-J-Z-E-R-T. Anyway, Leo, creative director at Agency G2, which is a WPP agency, who said that the government's tobacco plain packaging bill amounts to brand theft for tobacco companies. The law he's talking about is effectively it will replace branding on cigarette packets with a sort of just plain-faced packet with, I think, everything in the same fonts, sort of drab olive colour or something like that. But his argument is, you know, over many, many years, brand equity has been built up and, you know, intellectual property has been built up around these things, which is being taken away from them. You know, he openly declared in the piece that British American Tobacco is one of G2's clients. So you can see that he's coming from somebody who is a practitioner. Robin, the word theft. How do you feel about that, brand theft?
Yeah, I see his argument, but yeah, personally, I think that yeah, there's some as the comment stream mentioned that there are some brands that perhaps don't deserve to be allowed to play by the rules. That said, I do think that you know the marketing departments of tobacco companies are clever people and they'll get around it. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, branded packets of plastic sleeves cropping up sort of underground that's sort of cool and funky that people just slip over the unbranded packets. I'm sure that marketing departments will sort it out.
I'm sure they'll thank you for that.
Yeah, Chris, what would you, if strategically, if your client was a big tobacco company, what would you do?
Well, the first thing you've got to do is operate to the letter of the law. So if this law goes through, then you've got to do exactly what Robin suggested. You've got to look at what that brand is trying to achieve and how can you work within the letter of the law to achieve that, and finding other ways to attach your brand to a product is how you would go about that, and find other ways to attach the brand beyond the packet. I had a very interesting experience with this article, and I went in fully expecting to not agree and specifically disagree with what it was going to say. I found myself strangely sympathetic to the point that was being made. I think it is a very interesting and ethically troublesome position to be in when you've got a legally available product which is not allowed to brand itself. To go back to the origins of branding and why brands actually exist, they exist to protect us from the anonymity of the commodity. That's why brands exist. They are there to protect us from that and to give us some assurance of where that product has come from. Otherwise, it is just a commoditized good. And for a society to allow something to be legally available to purchase but not allow that commodity to have a brand and to be branded, I think raises actually very big questions. And I think that it is subjective, and I think arguably it's too subjective. And I think the question is, where does this stop, is a very valid and relevant question for our industry.
I think there are some people who work in marketing who would say, right, there are certain things I won't do. Some people, you know, they draw the line and say, I won't even be involved in promoting alcohol. You know, others, probably many, would say, I won't be involved in helping tobacco brands reach audiences because of, you know, the effect of the product on the public. What's your personal perspective?
My personal perspective on that is that I think you've got to balance the requirements and the obligations of your employer and the agency that you work with.
Would you make a decision, would it be a factor in making a decision on joining an agency that they had big tobacco as a client? Would it be one of the things you would weigh up?
It would be one of the things I would certainly consider. Would I let the fact that an agency represented a tobacco company personally prevent me joining an agency if I thought they were innovative, if I thought they were going in the right direction, if I thought they were a good agency? I probably wouldn't. I wouldn't let it stop me joining that agency. But I think that's a personal call, and I understand that some people will have a different point of view. That said, tobacco is arguably just the most potent in what is a whole range of subjective causes. Now, would increasingly, will you work for an oil or gas? Would you work for a slaughterhouse? Would you work for a whole, any one of a range of industries where people might have moral objections to what they do?
Robin, would you work in an
can open worms everywhere?
No, I wouldn't. To be honest, if I was to work for an agency, I'd have being a tree hugger, I'd have problems with an oil client, to be honest. But yeah, I just want to ask what you think about the packs the packs themselves, will they they're unbranded, right? But will they have the hideous sort of public health warnings with, and it just come from Singapore where they graphically show, you know, with ridiculous claims like smoking gives you gangrene, with a picture of a huge gangrenous foot on the packet of it. But I still see young people smoking away. I'm not sure it has much of an effect. But yeah, so will the packs have health warnings on them as well? Will that be the only sort of branding on them?
Alice, producer Alice, has knowledge of this topic.
I'm not a smoker, so I'm only guessing, but I have a feeling that is part of it. Maybe not the images, but the, you know, smoking harms your baby message, I have a feeling will be a part of the pack.
It would seem like a step backwards to then take them off in terms of, you know, the educational process. Next, rocking out with the latest radio rankings.
The latest of the radio ratings were released this week. Here's a quick rundown. So in Adelaide, ABC 89.891 and Mix were neck and neck at the top. In Perth, 96FM saw a big drop from 10% to 7.7, one of the biggest in the country, while Mix 94.5 sat at top spot. B105 in Brisbane maintained its lead in Brisbane, while Nova fell back. In Melbourne, Classic Rock, which had been struggling for some time, now has finally shown some progress, showing the biggest increase of any station in the Victorian capital. And Sydney, well, it's a bit boring, actually, with not a single station or show gaining or losing even 1% in share, meaning 2GB maintained its dominance. Chris, you're a radio listener, and also just a quick point on Sydney. Is that a bad sign for the market, the fact there's been no shift at all? Not yet. That struck me as amazing that, you know, the market is so stagnant.
Stagnant is stability, is right. is a glass half full version of stagnant, I suppose. And I think I'm not a huge radio listener. Most of my listening from an audio point of view tends to be recorded or podcasted. But I think that certainly in Sydney, what you've got is a lot of stability. And I think that right now, in what is a fairly buoyant and strong radio market, a lot of people will be quite happy with that. That things are same things are as they were, and the market's doing okay.
Yeah. So Tim, about Classic Rock, did well. Do you think it'll continue its climb?
I mean, did well off a relatively low base. So Melbourne, just looking at it now, yeah. So up from 2.8 share to 4 share. That's the Monday to Friday share. Still struggling at breakfast. I mean, it was up a bit, but 2.9 share in breakfast. They had a change of breakfast host about halfway through as well. So we'll see how that settles. But yeah, very early days. And Classic Rock, not making much progress in Sydney, though. So, you know, pretty much steady, went up from a 2.5 share to 2.6. Breakfast actually went down fractionally. So I think we must be coming to the year anniversary since Vega rebranded as Classic Rock. So, you know, as Chris says, stagnant or stability, you know, at least it's not sort of falling away anymore. But at the same time, you know, that's an expensive license to have. I know that the management at the station argue that, well, because they control costs on it, it's a profitable station because, you know, it's not as expensive to run as Vega was, for instance. You know, less presenters, less big name presenters on big contracts. I think there's still some way to go. But the thing is, it's sounding less and less like Classic Rock and slightly more mainstream, which arguably is why it's getting more listeners, but also, you know, the danger is it loses its point of differentiation and the reason for its name. I'm also amused, by the way, for the fact that we, I think for the first time ever, did Adelaide's ratings first, which might be something to do with Alice having written the script being from Adelaide, I suspect. But sorry, you were saying.
Any other surprises? Yeah, just any other surprises that struck you from the results?
Yeah, I mean, Brisbane, I guess I was sort of expecting things to maybe go in another direction, in that the last time round it felt like Nova had got some momentum and it had sort of come back, and it was absolutely neck and neck with Austereo's B105. And actually B105 has kind of extended its lead again, so that's sort of, you know, sort of just stretched its pace again. So I think we're going to see Brisbane go back and forth for a while. But I think the other thing about this sort of set of the ratings as well is because the way the ratings work, particularly this time of the year where some of the sample is included in the previous set of ratings as well, that tends to sort of smooth the curves up and down a bit, you know, a little bit too. Whereas like the first one of the year is always the one where you tend to see big changes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think just you know, one word of caution is that, you know, these are ratings. I think there's a slight danger you can get a bit too forensic about them. They are a measurement, and they're subject to statistical variation, like a lot of things are.
Particularly because it's the diary system as well.
Exactly. So I think that certainly what we try to do is we try to think about what's the longer term momentum that certain stations have got, and what are the longer term stories. I think that a lot of stations, what you've seen is some fairly significant changes, some which have been marketed quite heavily, which have held true. And I think that for a station to make what are certainly quite significant changes to lineups and then maintain share, it will be seen as a very positive result. And I think that understanding those stories and then the stories behind the numbers, I think, is very important, certainly when you're making planning and buying decisions.
So this set of results won't make you guys at PhD rush out and change your radio spend, for example?
Certainly hope not.
So next, talent contests, budding chefs and a sack of potatoes in this week's TV ratings.
To advertise with one of the top 10 most loved brands in Australia, visit advertise.ebay.com.au.
It's been an eventful week in telly with MasterChefs, Australians with Talent, and yes, that dancing sack of potatoes. So MasterChef started the week winning the ratings race against Australia's Got Talent, although the tables gradually turned as the week went on. On Tuesday, we saw MasterChef come in just behind AGT, if I can shorten it to that, and then it was the same again on Wednesday night as well. And that was a very competitive night. I would argue possibly one of the most competitive nights of the ratings year so far, with some of the challenge coming from the ABC. Angry Boys making its debut, Chris Lilley's new comedy on ABC One, which pulled in about 1.4 million. So you've got Angry Boys doing 1.4, you've got MasterChef doing 1.4 on 10, and you've got Australia's Got Talent doing 1.5. So those are strong audiences across the board. Squeezing out Nine to a certain extent, though Nine had another very, very bad night. So that was one thing going on. Also this week in the ratings, we had the Dancing with the Stars controversy with Bubbly, Buxom, Bryn, Edelstein, I must confess I'm not sure how one would pronounce it, but being described by the mean judges as a dancing sack of potatoes. Let's have a listen.
It was a very chooky cha-cha, and you looked like a bedazzled sack of potatoes rolling down on the floor. It was shocking.
Chris, bit harsh.
Oh, welcome to the pantomime, Tim. Welcome to the pantomime of celebrity reality television. I think that anyone who's got too harsh a thing to say about this, at best, doesn't quite grasp the rules of the game, and at worst, is really not giving much credibility to what actually is going on here. This is reality TV. It's celebrity reality TV, and those people who go on those shows know exactly the kind of forum they're going into.
Now, another big event, I suppose, in the programming was, because there tends to be long gaps between Ms. Chris Lilley. Did you watch Angry Boys?
It was an event in our household. It was quite the event. I watched
so
it last night.
Talk me through. Was there some cooking?
There was some cooking. There was about that animated barbecue.
What's the correct snack to watch with Chris Lilley?
Well, we went with an Angry Boys theme, so lots of meat. And lots of strong red wine. So it was, and some friends over. It was great. It was really good. It's great to see Chris Lilley back. I was in the UK when Summer High Tie landed on our shores. I was unaware of Heroes until I came over here. He's a great talent. It's a great show. It crosses the line, but it crosses the line in the way that I think is knowing and appropriate. And shouldn't be taken in the wrong way.
Now that's the question, isn't it? As we're speaking now, I haven't actually taken my makeup off from being on Sunrise this morning yet, where I was lined up.
I wasn't going to say anything. But
well, I was lined up to talk about it, and obviously the difficulty is it's sort of before having seen it, and I suspect I was a bit of a disappointment, really, because I didn't find it controversial, and yes, I suppose I was, it was perhaps anticipated that we'd be more so. One thing to remember, of course, is a lot of the potentially more sort of controversial characters, you know, the kind of him being blackface as a gangster rapper who's actually terribly middle class, which obviously is a sort of nod towards Eminem. The pushy Japanese mother who wants her son to be gay so that it is a good selling point for his skateboard career. We haven't met those characters yet. You know, we know they're coming, but we haven't met them. So do you think there is some outrage yet to come? Genuine outrage?
Yeah, and I think that if they're smart, that they will have started fairly safe. They'll have started with some of the safer characters. Certainly Nathan and the farm boys are probably the safest of the characters that are arguably to come.
And returning characters as well.
And returning characters. And I thought Gran was great. I thought Gran was the most amazing character.
She's the kind of the juvenile detention centre warder or whatever the correct phrase
is. And I love the conversion of the narrative arcs as well, the fact that she was the boys' Gran at the end. Spoiler if you haven't seen that. But yeah, I thought the convergence of the two stories was really neat as well.
Before you say this,
yeah, that is kind of how it works. So, if you don't want to know the connection between the characters, stop listening about a minute ago.
Yes, just make yourself a time machine, and you'll be absolutely fine. Robin, do you, what do you think of this sort of? Let's go back actually to reality shows first of all. Are you a fan of reality shows where judges say mean things?
Not at all. I mean, I confess I haven't seen Australia's Got Talent yet. My diet of reality shows started with Big Brother in the UK on Channel 4. And I must confess, for a couple of seasons, I was utterly addicted, but then rapidly turned off. I haven't really tuned in since. But yeah, I wonder where reality shows are going, you know, after celebrities, after celebrity-based reality shows. What next?
Next? Well, I can tell you what next. The Bolt Report's Harsh Welcome.
News Limited columnist Andrew Bolt's new show, The Bolt Report, debuted on 10 on Sunday morning. But the talking point wasn't necessarily the content of the show, but more what followed. A Facebook group was set up calling on advertisers to boycott the show. Called Operation Bolt Cutter, as we record this, almost 1,200 people have been listed as attending the group. And one advertiser, Telechoice, is believed to have already pulled out. So, Tim, you thought it was a bit harsh?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. I thought it was a bit odd because effectively this is a campaign they want to go along, and they created it as an event rather than a full group, which, you know, it's just poor social media strategy, I felt. What do these punters know, eh? But yes, the problem I have with it is I'm not sure I would necessarily describe myself as sharing Andrew Bolt's politics. But I'm not totally comfortable with people just campaigning to have them taken off the air by boycotting advertisers, because, you know, it's not as if he's some sort of David Irving character who shouldn't be given the oxygen of publicity. You know, he should be entitled to prosecute the case of the right just as anybody else. You know, it's not, you know, this is a relatively niche show, couple of hundred thousand viewers, they're happy enough with that, I'm sure. So it kind of, you know, it feels a bit wrong, and it probably almost distracts from the fact that, you know, it's a show that certainly hadn't quite found its feet yet.
Chris, do you think that perhaps this sort of kerfuffle around his show could add to his value as a media property? And it seems that there's more interest in the fact that he's been allowed to do the show than almost the show itself, which didn't rate that well.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly that for a network to have that kind of debate around a character and around a show is healthy from that purely ratings point of view. It's a very healthy thing to be happening. I think that what we're seeing is it raised some very interesting questions around the fact that a minority group can, to all intents and purposes, hijack a show like that, and I think it raises very interesting questions. As someone who works in an agency that buys these spots and plans these spots, it raises very big questions about the relationship between advertisers and the programs they're in.
Yeah, that's interesting. Would you how much of a backlash against a brand do you think there would need to be before you would recommend a client don't be against this program because you could be caught in the backlash?
I think that is generally a client-led decision. I think clients are much better placed to judge how much controversy is too much than we necessarily are. I think we can advise them on the impact of that. We can advise them on the best deployment for their media. But I think clients always certainly best place to do that. A lot of clients do lay that in guidelines. So a lot of clients won't be in news, for example, in case the news agenda proves to be controversial and they don't want to be associated with that. So a lot of these guidelines are already in place. But it does bring to light the fact that a lot of clients and a lot of broadcast advertisers are passive contributors to a broadcast stream, and I think that should advertisers want to take a more proactive view of which programmes they're in is one thing. The other thing, of course, is are they able to do that because with TV fragmentation? Because the average spot viewing is going down, then we've got to buy a lot more spots. And as you buy a lot more spots, your degree of control over which spots you're in diminishes. So whether advertisers have control is a separate issue to whether they want control.
That is all we have time for today. Thank you again to PhD's Chris Stevenson.
Thank you very much.
And Mumbrella's Robin Hicks.
Cheers, Tim.
The Mumbrella cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. Production was by Alice Terlikovsky. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle pip. Welcome to the Mumbrella cast. I'm Tim Burrows. We welcome back to the podcast PhD Strategy Director Chris Stevenson.
Oh, hello there, Tim. Sorry, I was just making notes about what I was going to say. I'm sort of shocked to be here. It's like, where am I? Hello.
Let's take one more crack at that. Here we go, still rolling. Yeah.